The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Apologies for that. It is the biggest business story for decades. And the gremlins have decided to try and undermine us. But we will not be defeated. We will not be overcome. We will tell it all, as you need to understand, because it is one of the biggest and most important stories of the year. It really is. Or maybe of the decade. Maybe of the century so far, as far as the South African resources sector is concerned. Broke late last night, a bid by one of the world's biggest mining companies for another one. Both have got strong connections to South Africa. Australia's BHP Group, which about 20 years ago took over the now long forgotten Gencore, now wants to buy, of course, Anglo American. But it wants to get rid of Anglo's South African businesses first. The Mineral Resources Minister, Gwede Mantashe, is not supportive. And some investors are saying the offer's way too low to be taken seriously. There's only one person upon whom we can call to give us context and understanding of this, and that is the editor of MiningMax.com. His name is David Mackay, and he also has deep experience in South Africa's very, very interesting resources sector. If this does go ahead, David, it's going to be absolutely enormous, isn't it?
108-year-old business. But also, I think it could usher in, looking to the future, period of feverish M&A. I mean, that's the feeling that with this, there may be more. And with that, I guess the assumption is that some of the equities will start to look a little bit full. So in terms of the cycle, it'll give us a good indication of where we are, if this goes forward or not. But like you say, I mean, very important for those listed subsidiaries of Anglo's, Amplats and Kumba. I think the worry there, and the reason that Mantashe is against the deal, as you described, is that it leaves those companies very vulnerable. I mean, they do rely upon the balance sheets of the parent company, and as standalone companies, they may find cost of capital quite high and quite difficult to do certain projects. And then I just think for South Africa as a whole, just sort of looking internally at this, I mean, Anglo is, as it's been described to me today, quite elegantly as a convener of business in South Africa, very broadly, not just in mining, and also is able to leverage third-party finance for various projects and so on and so forth. So, you know, a lot of ramifications for South Africa. I must stress, though, let's not get ahead of the process. This is a proposal. It's a what about it? It's not an offer yet. We'll know by May 22nd, which is the cutoff date.
Okay. Now, this is all of this is important, and absolutely not by a country mile is this a done deal. It is a statement of intent, however, by BHP Group to Anglo American. Anglo American, which has not covered itself in glory in recent years and is in the process of its own internal restructuring at the moment. And I see some investors today saying, well, if Anglo wants to stay independent, it's really going to have to justify to its investors why they should back the Anglo team and not the BHP team.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the way this story has gotten out. It's also important to say that this proposal has been with Anglo's board for about 9 days already. It was obviously leaked into the press today by BHP, to try and sort of get a bit of wider reception as to, you know, as to how people think about it, how shareholders would think about it and the market in general. Interestingly, there's a Wall Street Journal article that says that Anglo has already opened discussions with potential parties on selling De Beers. Again, I imagine that's probably been leaked into the market by Anglo American in order to say, you know, we've actually got our own process in place. And I think that will be Anglo's defense on this. They'll defend on value. They'll say it's too cheap in terms of what's being put on the table by BHP. But they'll also say, hey, we're doing this ourselves. You know, we're already looking at De Beers. Likely it could get spun off now, sold. But then also, why stop there if you're going to defend this and say, you know, we as Anglo can do this better than BHP? Then I suppose you've got to turn your gaze on Amplats and Kumba. I don't think Anglo would have necessarily wanted to spin those out, but in the context of what BHP, its hand might be forced.
Yeah, there are just so many moving parts to this particular transaction. What, to your mind, has made Anglo vulnerable?
Oh, look, I mean, there was a correction in terms of, well, a crash in terms of platinum group metal prices, which put pressure on the business. And then Kumba didn't get underperformed based on the railing issues that we have in South Africa. They also did run into copper production problems at some of its South American assets, which caused a bit of a, you know, reduction in production guidance that always scares the market. And then I just think, you know, with the moving on of Mark Cutifani and the new guy, Duncan Wormbled, in place, there's always that adjustment of what's the new guy like? Does he command the same authority? He started a restructuring process internally, sort of decentralized the organization, tried to cut costs out of it. Normal type of business renewal process in place, but it always creates a bit of uncertainty. I think the combination of those things has probably, you know, provided the opportunity to BHP. I also think, though, that this says a lot about where the copper market is going. I mean, those are the assets that BHP really wants out of Anglo. It wants its South American copper assets and other base metals. And I think that tells us quite a lot about where the copper market is heading. And I think it's a call on that by BHP.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's sort of the industrial revolution, the third industrial revolution, metal, copper, which made communication possible and connected the world, is the fourth industrial revolution, metal as well, because it makes the technologies that are going to drive the metals that are going to drive the technologies that much more relevant once again. What do we read into BHP's aversion to the South African asset, so the Kumba asset, to the platinum assets and to De Beers? This isn't a we don't like South Africa bid. This is a we don't like the bits that are in South Africa bid, is my interpretation. What's yours?
I think they don't like South Africa. I mean, they've made that fairly plain when BHP was restructuring, when it dropped the BHP Billiton identity and became BHP, and it demerged South 32, a lot of the South African assets were in that. They don't like the risk. They don't like the trajectory in terms of policy and so on. We know all the issues, and so do they. And I think it's very much a call on that, and that's a sad indictment on us, I guess, on our government. But that's the name of the game.
Big investors in this, the sort of people, the sort of companies and the sort of entities that will have a say in this, are global asset managers, global owners of Anglo American, who, if they like the price, will say, yes, we want this deal to go ahead. Amongst those big investors is the biggest, and that is the Public Investment Corporation, manages money on behalf of the Government Employees Pension Fund. So government has got some leverage there, it can have some influence there.
Yeah.
Can it stop it in any way from a regulatory perspective if this is a deal that shareholders want to happen?
I'm not sure what the South African register is. I've got to absolutely confess. Potentially, they could be a swing vote in this. But it'll be interesting. I mean, one of the other aspects that might come out of this is that now that BHP's kind of played its hand in regard to Anglo, it might shake out other potential bids.
Exactly.
Now, the PIC, you know, might be against, you know, an Australian interloper stepping in. But would it be, I'm just saying, would it be against a Chinese offer coming in, given, you know,
a Russian offer or any other? Yeah.
Well, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the government sort of plays its hand on that particular front. No, but I think the PAC will vote against this. It's not in the interests of South Africa whatsoever, for reasons stated. We might get Glencore stepping in. It's got less antitrust issues in terms of a takeover of Anglo. It might potentially get Rio Tinto, valued lower but a better balance sheet. Might step into the fray. It's why I love mining. You know, I'm addicted to the sector. So I'll stop talking.
No, but It's got all of the... you couldn't write a Hollywood script on this sort of stuff. I mean, this is the stuff of boardroom battles. This is the stuff of high-stakes deal-making. It has got all of the elements of high drama to it and with very real-world consequences, Dave Mackay. And that's the issue here. This could significantly undermine South Africa's status as a global mining centre if Anglo-American was to disappear off the board, if it's small mining companies were to be left independent. In other words, the Anglo Platinums, the Kumbas and the De Beers of the world, or vulnerable to other takeover. And I think the ANC's big panic here, and maybe government's big panic, and maybe South Africa's big panic, is the outflow of capital. And that would be a big concern here as well. The mere fact that, you know, Anglos is so important and so interwoven in our economy is a big and important part of this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't put it better myself. And also against the backdrop of a general election, about 9 days after this, we'll know either way if BHP is coming in for Anglo. It's that will be the backdrop. So we shall see. It is a great diminishment. I mean, I think the mining sector in South Africa generally is under a lot of pressure, quite singularly for the fact that the resources aren't being renewed. And a lot of the projects that we do see are brownfield projects on assets with sunk capital. So the risk is fairly low. You know, extension, sort of what we call in mining LIFEX projects. There's not a lot of money going into new mines or the discovery of new resources. And that's the lifeblood of any mining sector. Without that, you're not growing. You're fading away. And so coupled with that, to lose, you know, something as massive as Anglo on the skyline of the South African corporate landscape, you know, it really would be a significant blow. Let's see. I think a large part of this also might be driven by management ego. I mean, for want of a better phrase, I mean, Duncan Wumblett might say, now, I'm the best person to run this. And he's got a project, a fertilizer project in Yorkshire. It's really his project. He might argue, we are the best company to develop that. I don't want to see this project be sidelined. And so I think that will be a factor as well.
Fascinating, as always. David Mackay, thank you for bringing your deep experience and wisdom on South Africa's mining sector. Been covering it for a long time. And thank you very much for your contribution this evening on The Money Show. He was on holiday. We took him out of it. David Mackay from miningmux.com.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Rudy Funimatt, here we go. Rudy is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Would you accept the BHP offer? Would you encourage your clients to accept the BHP offer as it stands at the moment, Rudy?
Evening, Bruce. No, I don't think I would. It seems to me a little bit light. You know, they've come in with somewhat of a premium for the unlisted assets, based on their sort of implied value at the moment. I don't know that there's enough there to compensate one for the potential upside that Anglo would produce and that those assets would produce over time. And the outlook longer term for copper seems to be really exciting. Even Billiton's own projections of the copper price going forward is way beyond what they're offering for these assets at the moment. And there's absolutely no sort of indication that there's one would be paid for the control premium of Anglo. So I don't think that this offer is interesting, and I think it might bring some exciting other offers to the fore, and it might be a negotiation starting point, but I don't know that they would get a lot of people throwing shares at them at this price.
Do you agree with David Mackay that this is a potentially quite vulnerable moment for South Africa, for the business sector in South Africa, for the South African economy, considering just how central and important Anglo-American is and how far it reaches and how deeply it reaches into virtually all aspects of the South African economy?
Yeah, it would make I think it is, Bruce. There are a lot of these assets that are external to South Africa that have been invested in by Anglo over decades, pretty much now, and they're at the point where they're getting quite close to the dividends flowing back in this direction. So it would be terrible if that ended up going to Australia instead. You know, the upside of all the South American assets. So yes, I do think it would be there's definitely some negative on this. Hopefully, we can get some positive catalysts out of it. One which could be, you know, better operational performance by Anglo themselves, and hopefully some better mining legislation would be very useful. You know, they wouldn't have found themselves possibly in quite as vulnerable position if the legislation here had been more rewarding of people investing in domestic resources.
And that's a big point. It's a point David Mackay makes as well, that the regulatory environment is not supportive of expansion and growth and development. And the fact that also we've got a broken transit, broken systems, all the stuff we talk about all the time that seems very distant. And, well, it only affects the people who dig holes in the ground and need to get this stuff to port. It doesn't really affect us. Suddenly, all of these chickens are very much coming home to roost in the vulnerability of Anglo American to take over with the demand from BHP that they don't want to take the stuff in South Africa.
No, that's quite true, Bruce. And we would miss out on a tremendous amount of longer-term upside and a lot of potential jobs and, you know, tax revenue and the like as well. So, yes, it would be, I think, significantly negative for South Africa, if it went through at these levels, yes.
We will, of course, be referring to this story throughout the show this evening with lots of different aspects that we will be tackling tonight, including in our investment school this evening, David Shapiro at SASFIN. Anglo-American proven to be vulnerable. Why? Because it has big copper investments. How does David Shapiro at SASFIN, very experienced stockbroker, somebody who's watched this sector and this industry and this country evolve economically over a long time, what does he see as the investment opportunity here? And how, when one big company goes to take over another company, what should you do? How should you respond as an investor? Whether it is if you have to deliver a proxy, whether you're as shareholders directly or indirectly, do you put pressure on your own unit trust manager to vote in a particular way? Will you participate in it anyway? Clicks came out with results today. Now, Clicks hasn't really done anything dramatic and shape-shifting in recent years, but certainly it has become a very reliable performer on the JSE. A little unexciting, perhaps, but reliable.
Has been very reliable, Bruce. And as a result, it's gotten quite a premium rating, you know, amongst the domestic retailers. It's mainly a cash retailer. It was the first really significant issue of loyalty programs that were significantly successful. And the product that it sells is regarded mainly as quite defensive. So pharmaceuticals and beauty products and the like, you know, tend to be things that people sort of need to consume rather than the choices people make to consume. So it has built up a very consistent track record of generating cash flows and producing significant profit growth quite well ahead of the rest of the domestic retail sector. So over time, it has very much earned this spot that it's sort of scratched out for itself. The results now, as you say, are not super shoot the lights out exciting. Sales were up sort of 9%. They did improve margins slightly. And so headline earnings are fair up 13-odd%. Return on equity is very good, so the return on capital around 43-odd%. They are having, it seems like the UPS business has had quite a dull sector and has been restructured quite significantly from a systemic perspective. And I think the prospects in that portion of the business are better going forward. It's going to be a little bit difficult, I think, to substantiate the current rating. You know, it's probably a forward PE in the region of 25 or 26 or so.
Sure.
I don't know that 13% annual earnings growth is quite enough to substantiate a rating quite that high.
Rudy Fundamadva, thank you very much, Rudy. The two big stories on the day, Anglo-American, vulnerable to takeover. BHP Group looking to buy the business for 700 billion rand. It doesn't look like it's going to go ahead. Certainly not at this level. BHP Group will have to pay up considerably. South Africa's government will push back strongly for the reasons that we've discussed this evening. It is a big and important and evolving story, one that comes to a head on the 22nd of May, when there will have to be a commitment of some kind, and whether shareholders rebel against it and say, no, this so far and no further. It's going to be a really interesting development, and one that is critical, of course, for the South African economy, broadly speaking. Today, though, we were global outliers. They were down, but not nearly as much as the United States, as European markets were down on the day. Anglos added 18% by the close of trade. It ended at 606 Rand 66 on the day. A very big jump on the day. Still not enough, however, to entice many of its investors to accept the offer from BHP Group. More on the story as the show unfolds.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
Welcome to the Money Show on this very eventful Thursday. In case you missed it earlier, Anglo American is finding itself the subject of a potential takeover bid by larger rival BHP Group. There is not too much enthusiasm, certainly in public at least, from many of Anglo American's investors at the levels at which BHP has leveled its price, which is around the 700 billion rand level. It's a vast amount of money. It will, of course, it would change the structure of the JSE. It would change the way in which companies like Kumba and Anglo American Platinum operate. As David Mackay from MoneyMax explained it, they rely heavily on the Anglo-American balance sheet, and it's with BHP not wanting to buy South African businesses and rather focusing on the South American businesses, particularly those focusing on copper, it is a very strong indictment on the South African mining environment, and something that if there is not a very, very significant reform of, will make our mining companies and our economy and the structure of the JSE and the value of your pension fund buy in the longer term increasingly vulnerable. We'll talk to David Shapiro about it, though. Calm our nerves about this one this evening. That happening on our investment school at 7:30. Well, the Clicks business model of integrating pharmacies into its health and beauty stores is a business model that's continued to perform very well for investors in Clicks. The retailer started more than 50 years ago by an entrepreneur by the name of Jack Golden. Jack Golden used the money he earned from the sale of his four pick-and-pay stores to a young guy called Raymond Ackerman in the late 1960s to begin. And unlike many South African retailers, which have been looking for better opportunities offshore than at home, Clicks, certainly under the leadership of its former chief executive, a former chief executive, the ex-Boots executive, David Neal, instead of following the herd out of the country, instead focused on the domestic market, saw the opportunity in bringing pharmacy into the stores and saw that as a draw card, and that has grown the business and certainly delivered solid returns over time. Bettina Engelbrecht is the chief executive officer of Clicks. It's a strategy that's strong. It's a strategy that's dependable. It's a strategy that is working. Is it a strategy that will continue to satisfy your investors in the longer term? Bettina, good evening.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Great question, and thank you very much for the lead-in as well. Definitely. I think, you know, we've got a path to grow. When you're thinking about pharmacy market share, which of course is a key driver of our overall growth, then you'll see, you know, we've only got 24% market share. And if you put all of corporate retail pharmacy together, it's around about 50% market share. Now, if you look at the rest of the world where this sort of drugstore model also prevails, actually corporates get up to 70 to 80% of the total market share. So
what?
Quite, yep. So, you know, lots of room for growth. And then we could not yet have begun to fully explore the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. We can already see that our stores in Namibia, Botswana, Lesotho, Eswatini are doing phenomenally well. And right now we are contemplating Zambia.
Is there pressure by your shareholders to go beyond the borders, to expand into other markets? Some have done it successfully. Some have come horribly unstuck. You seem to be going as the style of Clicks is, very cautiously, very conservatively, very with a great deal of caution into the markets. How is it playing out, and what sort of dynamics are at play in the background here?
Well, you know, the way that we look at it, I wouldn't say cautious. I would say that we try and make sure, you know, that we understand the market, that we have got a value proposition that will work within that market, that we've got the right teams and the right locations, and, you know, then we plan for it and then we execute the plan. That's what we really well, you know, we've got that capability. We are excellent at execution and being very, very disciplined in our delivery as well. So, you know, retail is about getting a recipe and then perfecting the recipe and rolling out the recipe. And that's what we've done really very well and consistently so.
Your most recent deal was the acquisition of Sorbet, and you've also bought MChem and a software development company called 180 Degrees. Those all done last year. Sorbet is the most, I think, visible business certainly in the public eye, started by entrepreneur Ian Furr, bought and held briefly by the Bitvest founder Brian Joffe in an investment firm. He was hoping to bring together a United Colors of Benetton Bitvest sort of an investment company. He then sold that on to private equity and Old Mutual, who then sold it on to you. Is it settled? Is it all in place? Is everybody
settled
happy? Is
very, very
it all
well
going swimmingly?
Yeah, we understand, you know, how to evaluate a potential acquisition. We look for a couple of very key things, such as, for example, what's the return that we're going to be earning from it? Do we believe that it's been well run, that it's got a reputable management team, that they've performed ethically, that there's an alignment in terms of our vision and mission as an organization? And then importantly, are we able to extract synergies, and do we believe that in our hands it will do much better than in the hands of the target? And so Sorbet really even outperformed the Clicks business, up 14.9%. And importantly, you know, a whole new demographic for us is that metrosexual man in South Africa. You know, Sorbet Man has performed exceptionally well, as have the new hybrid format. So very interesting, and we've already had approaches from north of our South African borders for individuals that are interested in taking Sorbet as a master franchise into the rest of Africa. So interesting times ahead.
Okay, good. The salon concept. What about, of course, the marvelous business, the values? Well, when it started out, the values driven business of Body Shop, which was then went into corporate and was owned by a big multinational. You guys got the rights to exclusive rights to import and to operate Body Shops in South Africa. Business went bust this last year, certainly in the UK, and I'm unsure as to what the future of Body Shop holds and how your relationship is affected as a result of the loss of the initial love for Body Shop that you know was held under Anita Roddick.
Well, you know, I'm a very key Body Shop customer myself, and you know, it's not something that I would easily move away from, and that's really, I think, the Body Shop customer. I would have said that the important thing to know is that the Body Shop has got two components to it. The one part is the franchise business, and we form part of the franchise operation of the Body Shop International. And what the owners or realtors have reassured us is that, first of all, the franchise businesses across the world are profitable. And the Body Shop, which franchise that we hold, has always performed in the top two or three of all of the franchise operations, in fact, even number one. And then, you know, the Body Shop franchise business is very key to their future profitability and therefore their future strategy. Now, the area that everybody is focusing on at the moment is the other part of the Body Shop International, which are their corporate retail businesses, meaning company-owned. And in the USA, the UK, and Canada, they have placed that under administratorship. And part of that really is just the legal process in those countries aimed at really right-sizing the businesses in those countries. But, you know, I think...
So you've still got factories that work, you've still got supply chains that work, yes. You're still getting body butter and all the other smelly stuff into South Africa. Forgive me for being technical on this, Bettina. You're getting the lotions and potions onto the shelves, yes. And as far as you can tell, it continues.
Yeah, no, as far as it all continues. In fact, over the peak Christmas trading period, they launched some new variants, Bluebell being one of them. And I just bought Bluebell last week, and everybody in my household is certainly raving about it. So I think, yeah, interesting times ahead. Yep, definitely.
It's horrible to be persona non grata in your own home. Bettina Engelbrecht, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive at Clicks. Good news on the front that we, even though Body Shop globally under pressure, South Africa maintains its franchise agreement. In a moment, we're going to talk to the co-founder of Bank Zero, Michael Jordaan, on the day where the Reserve Bank spelled out how deposit insurance is going to work in your bank account. Explain it all in a moment.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
When VBS was raided by a mix of corrupt auditors, complicit municipalities, rogue bankers, and a mix, we believe, of heartless politicians, government stepped in to guarantee deposits, up to a point. More than 20 years ago now, small banks crisis, Trevor Manuel did the same thing, forced to announce that the state would guarantee bank deposits as panic ripped through the financial system in South Africa following the collapse of SAMBO. That led to a run on deposits at BOE. Nedbank stepped into the breach there, bought BOE. It looked vulnerable. There were run on deposits at Nedbank in those days. And government eventually went, hold on a second, don't worry, we will stand behind deposits. Because banking is all about confidence. There's no bank in the world that can pay out all of its depositors at a moment's notice. But you and I need confidence that if we do want our money, whatever there is of it, we can get it. Michael Jordaan's been connected to banking, I think, all of his working life, and is the co-founder of Bank Zero. And the Reserve Bank, I think, Michael, today laying out the framework of bank insurance, deposit insurance, up to a maximum of 100,000 rand per depositor per bank. It's quite a big alignment in terms of global best practice, as far as I can work it out.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me. Yes, it is exactly. We are the last of the G20 to institute formal deposit insurance in South Africa. So it really is a big thing. The fact that all these other systems think it's a good idea and we took our time to do so. But as you rightly pointed out, that is probably because government has stepped in. So we've had implicit deposit insurance, but what this changes now is that we have very explicit deposit insurance. It's up to 100,000 per depositor per bank. And out of interest, that means that 93% of all South African depositors will be covered by this deposit insurance scheme.
How would it work? Do I have to pay an insurance fee to get that cover? Is it something that is sort of hidden in my bank charges? How does that work?
No, you don't have to pay at all. This is a levy that the banks will pay to the deposit insurance scheme. It's a small levy. In fact, it's 0.215%. Plus, they also extend a loan of 3% of these covered deposits to the entity. It's called the Corporation for Deposit Insurance. It's held by the Reserve Bank. So the cost of insuring this is borne by the banks, as it should be. In the past, in the implicit deposit insurance scheme, you could argue that it was effectively the taxpayer that would pay up the cost for bailing out depositors from failed banks. So this is back to banks where it should be. It does provide them, you know, with the incentives to manage their risk properly. Obviously, banks in South Africa still have to hold all the capital that they need. We are well regulated. We actually suffer far less from bank failures than many other systems. But what will happen now is that there will be more confidence in the system overall, and that customers, which before didn't want to move their bank accounts for fear of going to a less safe bank or a perceived less safe bank, can now do so. And that we see as very positive, particularly coming from a challenger bank perspective.
No, exactly right. And for people who, let's say you have keep, I don't know why you would, but you keep 500,000 rand in a bank account. If you feel vulnerable, you may then take your 500,000 rand and split it over five banks. And you and Discovery Bank and the soon to be launched Old Mutual Bank and Time Bank may all be beneficiaries, of course, of these 100,000 rand deposits. Because they are guaranteed, there will be no concern around whether or not investors will be able to get their money back should something go wrong in the system.
That's right, Bruce. You see, banks are special. They're special entities in the economic system. If your corner shop fails, that's inconvenient, but it's not as big a deal. When a bank fails and it holds the savings of a nation, it has huge repercussions, not just the payment system that is interrupted, but you know, people that have worked hard for their savings get punished. And we saw that with DBS Bank and with the African Bank and the 13 other banks that have failed in the last three decades. So it really does make sense to offer this explicit insurance. It does mean people can shop around. And the nice thing is where people were loath to shop around before, they knew they could open an account easily, they knew fees were lower, they knew service could be better, but they wanted their deposits with the big banks. Big banks were seen as too big to fail. Obviously, that has now changed. You mentioned the situation where somebody could spread around their deposits. We think that is likely to happen. But once again, I need to point out that for 93% of the number of depositors, yeah, the scheme as it is now is adequate already. But even for them, they don't need to bank with the big five anymore now. The challenger banks with, we would argue, the superior innovation, lower fees like we have at Bank Zero, that now really becomes an option for 93% of the population of South Africa, and that includes businesses.
Banker Michael Yordan, who is the founder at Bank Zero.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this Thursday evening, this eventful Thursday evening. The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Now, Anglo American is one of the most valuable investments on the JSE. It is a dual-listed company. It has a head office and a listing on the London Stock Exchange as well. It is also the subject of a takeover bid by the world's biggest mining company in BHP Group. Gwede Matashi, as you heard in Eyewitness News, opposed to the investment of the idea. Not a fan of BHP. We don't know the exact reasons for that. But BHP not exactly a fan of South Africa either in terms of the environment for mining companies. The regulatory system in South Africa is not supportive of new exploration. It is quite a restrictive environment. It is an environment in which it is very difficult for producers to get their products to market for all of the failings we talk about so often. So we will talk this evening in some detail to David Shapiro in our investment school at 7:30. David, very wise, many years of investing experience as to how this is likely to pay out and how you should, as an active member in your retirement fund, your pension fund, as an active investor yourself, perhaps, how you might respond to this bid by BHP of Anglo American. Would you vote for it? Do you support it? Do you vote against it? Do you sell your shares in Anglos at a premium to what they were trading last week and go and find yourself some attractive copper businesses around the world to invest in? Because that's certainly the signal that is being sent by BHP. Oh, well, all of that is possible. Professor Adrian Saville standing by. I want to talk to him about sovereign wealth funds. And Pavlo joins us in just a few minutes, all about small business this evening and the value of talent in your business, how you identify it and how you appoint it and how you inspire it and how you keep it and how you treat it as a very important asset rather than just something that goes home at the end of the day and you hope turns up tomorrow morning. Tonight, all on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, Professor Adrian Saville, who teaches economics and finance at Gibbs, had a particularly interesting post the other day drawing attention to the success of Norway's sovereign wealth fund. There's a reason why Nordic countries always rank among having some of the happiest citizens on earth, despite spending around half the year, maybe I'm exaggerating, in near darkness most of the day. Successive governments in that country, particularly Norway, but in other Nordic countries too, have taken very good decisions how best to secure their citizens' long-term prosperity. And part of that has been through the creation of sovereign wealth funds, which are a politically delightful tool in a country like South Africa, where government is often berated for being unstrategic, where it is often berated for not being as proactive as many other countries in the world. Invariably, Adrian, South Africans will go, why can we not also have a sovereign wealth fund? I think Tito Mboweni mentioned it at one time. I'm not sure if the current finance minister has talked about it at all, but it is an attractive idea, isn't it?
It's a very attractive idea, Bruce. And the reason why we don't have one, it's not why we can't have one. We can have one. Any country can have a sovereign wealth fund that, you know, it most obviously is built out of having an endowment of natural resources. And any country can choose to do it, but most don't. And there's a, it lands up in a very big distinction between, you know, what we could call resource-cursed and resource-blessed countries. And the resource-cursed countries are well known. Many of them are African, but not exclusively African. A lot of Latin American economies are resource-cursed. But by choosing to build a sovereign wealth fund, it's at least one of the passages to turning a resource curse into a blessing.
What are the requirements for a country to have a sovereign wealth fund? For a country like South Africa, which is pays R1 billion a day in interest on its borrowings, where it has got a huge social net that needs support, where its tax collections are insufficient to meet its spending, it is in debt, it is in trouble in terms of not an increasing proportion of its annual budget is spent on non-productive things, so things that don't bring growth. How could South Africa go about it?
Well, if you look at the successful funds around the world, and you've spoken about Norway's fund, which incidentally, it translates into wealth in the fund of about $290,000 for every citizen of the country. it's an eye-watering number. And they're not alone. We can find many other successful examples. You know, other big funds include China's Investment Corporation, the Kuwait Investment Authority, Temasek, the Singaporean fund, is probably, you know, well known to many listeners. I would suggest that there's three things that are necessary to...
And then he goes silent. Don't go silent on me, Professor Adrian Saville.
Oh, Adrian Saville, Professor.
There you are. You disappeared. You disappeared. And you said there are things that are meant to be. And then you just were like, you were keeping secrets from us.
Well,
but that's okay. What needs to be present?
So the three things that need to be present are institutions that are capable of implementing this and managing and governing. The second is a clear set of rules or principles. And this isn't about the fund, but rather the fiscal rules of what you do with your sovereign wealth that comes from natural resources. And then the third is you need intent. You need, you know, that you're going to put your heart and your common purpose into building this fund. And importantly, you know, a sovereign wealth fund is designed not just for today's citizens. It recognizes, in part, that the fact that you discovered the resources doesn't make them yours. You know, if we're going to be a little bit animated, we could say this belongs to all Norwegians.
And therefore, it raises the issue for a country like South Africa, where there is a mineral resources regime, where there is private sector exploitation of the resources in return for providing jobs that, you know, provide a tax flow for the government, in return for providing profits, which provide taxes for the government, in return for royalties, which was a relatively new addition in the last 10, 15 years for the country. There is a school of thought that says, well, we should do what Norway did, and Norway nationalized its oil assets, and therefore it is the best way to follow. And it's only the best way to follow, of course, if you trust the people who are doing the nationalizing, which isn't always the case, in South Africa.
So, you know, that's the point, Bruce, about institutions, is institutions are absolutely imperative to make sure that the resource is well managed, that the assets are well governed, appropriately allocated, administered, and so on. You know, that's why the institutions are so critical. And if we look at the cases of the two good examples we've got in this conversation, Singapore's Temasek and the Norwegian Fund,
Absolutely. You know, what they suggest is that it's not ownership that matters as much as the management of those assets. So put them in, forget about the ownership, put them in the right hands, and you'll get a result that is a very powerful outcome.
It's fascinating, Adrian. It really is, particularly at a time, and this is a slight hospital pass, but let's go there anyway, where, you know, David Mackay at Mining Max... We're going there. And David Mackay at Mining Max was telling us earlier today that, you know, a deal, an acquisition by BHP Group of Anglo Americans, not necessarily in the best interest of the country. It's quite tough.
It may not be. Anglo-American, unfortunately, has sat on assets that have struggled for some time. The platinum assets, probably the most obvious case in point. Other assets, very strong cash generators. But interestingly, you know, when BHP has proposed this transaction, they have suggested that the South African assets need to get left behind. That's a big statement in that proposed transaction. If it were to transpire, I think one of the gems that no pun intended that Billiton is after is the copper assets in Latin America.
Yeah. No, absolutely right. That's what has been stated. Professor Adrian Saville, thank you. The Professor of Economics and Finance at Gibbs. Just a really interesting post. And then the reactions to it are, well, you see, we should also have one. Yes, we should. But it's not just as complicated as saying, let's, get a blank check and start buying assets and that we can then hold as custodians for future generations to ensure long-term national wealth, unfortunately. You do have to trust the custodians of that wealth, would you?
The Money Show.
Small business.
With Pavlo Fatidis.
And welcome to Pavlo Fatidis. And I wonder what you regard as one of the biggest corporate lies of all time. What do companies tell people that they want them to believe, but isn't true? Our people are our biggest asset. Our most valuable asset goes downstairs in the lift in the evening. What I suspect they mean to say most of the time is most of our people are pretty useful to us. They're expensive, so we like to ensure that we get good value out of them. And when they go down in the lift in the evening, we do what we can to make sure they come back tomorrow. And if they don't, well, we get rid of them and we get new ones. It's a bit cynical. Pavlo Fatidis is at Auric Business Accelerator. He's the founder. An overly cynical view, perhaps, Pavlo, or not?
I don't think. I think it's a profoundly practical view. And the reason for it is in very large corporates, you've got big budgets, you've got big cash flow capabilities based on years and years and years of growth and years and years and years of accumulated capital and momentum. You can afford to solve your people problem through a paycheck and a paycheck alone. So I don't think that that's necessarily untrue. I've seen remarkable people join corporates, and when they leave corporates, they're simply replaced. It's just another person. Smaller,
yeah, that's
medium-sized
within
business,
the corporate
Bruce.
Environment. Absolutely.
Yeah, very different story. Very different story. One person can have a significant impact. And a lot of people, I think, wrongly or dangerously invest in that notion that we're looking for the white knight, the silver bullet, the one individual who can come and make the big difference that we need made in our business in order to grow our own business. And I think it is a very dangerous attitude or view that still persists right across economies.
So then, okay, we run a business and we've got 10 people and we think, well, number 11 is going to make all the difference, and they do, and we start to relying and depending on number 11, and it's all going very nicely indeed. The danger there, of course, is if they decide to go down in the lift one day and don't come back the next, you are really in trouble. The corporate can, sort of fudge it for a while and, find alternative, make an alternative arrangement. For a medium-sized business, that can be devastating, can be the death knell, in fact.
Yeah, you know, if you really are to look at people and say, well, what do people bring to a business? We've got talent, and talent is very different to skill. You know, skills typically earn through years of experience and practice in many ways. You can develop a skill. You might have a natural aptitude towards a particular kind of skill, and that's helpful and useful. But true talent is unusual, and it's rare. And then you also just have general labor. In other words, somebody can come on board and get a job done. And I'm not going to talk about culture and values, because it then starts to become very, very difficult to consolidate a single perspective or point of view in managing that. If we're talking about that one individual, that person who's got specifically talent, there are a whole lot of issues with it. The first is the likelihood of you being able to afford them is low. If they've got talent and they've exercised that talent and they have delivered results on the back of that talent, in other words, it's talent that can translate into good economics for the employer, why would they come to you? You know, what would set you apart from the big corporate paychecks that are waved at these people? The second thing is, if talent does come on board, well, then who's in control of the business? Does talent wave the proverbial tail of the business, or does the business manage the talent in the direction of the business? And very often, that talent has let's call it a heavier perspective or attitude or influence on the business itself. Next, you then start to depend on the talent. And Bruce, when you start to depend on the talent, in many ways, you're arguing it to yourself as a business owner that without that talent, what is the business that I have? There was a case the other day, I spoke to a business owner who has 40% of their revenue being driven by one individual. And their relationship with that individual is online. It's virtual. There's a long relationship between that individual and the company. But if that individual were to say, I'm no longer available at your service, or to remain in service, I need to double up my income and earning, where does it leave you? That's where typically the tail wags the dog. And then
this is really important, because you're immensely grateful for the skills and the talent of that one individual. And yes, it exposes you disproportionately to a vulnerability in your business, but without them, you wouldn't be earning the money. So surely you've then got to be managing as best you can the talent to ensure that, one, they're happy, two, they're well incentivized, three, they're not likely to jump ship. And if they do, well, you better have a plan B somewhere in the background.
Well, I think you need to get ahead of all of those factors and features. Yes, absolutely. You want to try and hold talent on board. You want to keep talent inspired. You want to give them a good reason to be in your company and to remain in your company. But Bruce, I still don't like it. I still don't like it. You know, sport is a wonderful analogy, especially football, because typically in any football side, there's the star striker, the Messi or the Ronaldo or whoever it may be at any point in time. And yet, does one player make a team? Does one player build the team? Without the rest of the team, they're feeding the benefit of this individual's ability to score those goals. Well, on their own, they're not worthy of anything. And yet, you look at the cost of those individuals in a team itself. It has pushed many of these professional sports teams to the edge of sustainability, and in some cases into bankruptcy. So I think you need to get ahead of this in a more meaningful way, in a far more fundamental or practical way. And
what
if you can get
that
solution,
right. What's the solution then to the talent problem? You want the talent. You're grateful for the talent. If the talent is helping you build and develop your business, you know, they become essential and indispensable. I know nobody's indispensable. They become a really important part of your business, and in that you expose yourself and you become vulnerable to an accident, a departure, whatever it might be, perhaps destructive behaviors, whatever it might be. So how do you then guard against the potential downside of the person upon whom you have depended so much no longer being able to work for you, or no longer working for you, or no longer wanting to work for you?
Yeah, that really is the nub of the issue. So the starting point is, well, why are you doing what you're doing? And it sounds trite, but ask this question every single day that I meet business owners, and you'll be surprised how few people can actually answer that question in a clear, consistent, coherent manner. But if what you're doing is there to earn economy for yourself, well, then be opportunistic, onboard the talent, and in effect, ride that winning horse to the extent that you can as a jockey. But when the horse decides to bolt to another stable or another racetrack, everything you've built, you lose. But that wasn't your intent in the first place. Your intent was to, in effect, take a bet on an individual that made money while they were with you. Outside of that, they're gone, and you are where you were before they started. I think it's a lousy approach, that, because it's sloppy, it's lazy, and it doesn't have a deeper intent behind it. If your intent, however, is to create a business that's built into an asset, in other words, a business that generates income on a consistent basis, that improves its capital value, and of a day, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years from today, you can exit it for a capital gain in order to recover a great return on all your investment over the last 30 years. If that's your approach, when seeking talent, first understand how and where the talent will be of value to you. So know why you're employing the talent. Let's say, for example, it's going to be in sales, which is where most people seek talent, or in operations, the service delivery, the service fulfillment side, where the second demand for talent lies. In both those instances, Bruce, onboarding that talent needs to have, in tune with it, in parallel with it, a technique with which to, in effect, decode how that talent behaves in order to deliver the value that that talent does deliver. So, for example, if it's somebody in sales, how is it that they bring the sales in consistently? Do they have fantastic prospecting capabilities? And if so, how do they prospect? And your relationship with that individual, asking the many, many questions to slowly unpick and unpack and then restitch together how they prospect into a system of activities, is essentially how you start yielding a return on investment on that talent. If it's in the sales engagement process, outside of personality, what are the activities or processes or steps that very often talent itself is unaware of that they take to convert interest into a customer? That in itself then forms a system of selling. And once you have, in effect, decoded talent into a system of activities, it creates a framework within which an individual using, running, operating, managing that system can bring their personality to bear, but within the framework itself. If you can get that right, then investing in talent and ensuring that the value lies in the business rather than in the individual is how you get a far greater and more satisfactory return as the owner or investor in that talent in the first place.
It's an absolutely critical path to take here, Pavlo. But for most people, especially founders of businesses who have started the thing from scratch, who understand the nuts and bolts, who know how it works and are grateful for the help that comes in, you've got to get this process started sooner rather than later. You can't be sort of looking at this key individual and watching them excel and harvesting the rewards and a year in going, ooh, I better, you know, mitigate against the risk here because this person is so brilliant and if they leave, I'm in trouble. And then suddenly trying to reverse manage them into a framework. Rather, I suppose, what, start at the beginning? It's a very good place to start.
Well, very much so. You've got to set the ground rules at the beginning with everyone that you employ within your organization. And, you know, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to do because, as you rightly say, and you used the word grateful over there. Very often when you're in the early phases of a building, of a business, or in the growing stages of a business, and mostly you're feeling out of depth and mostly you feel to a degree like an imposter because you don't have all the answers and you have someone who opts to come on board because they're excited about your business. That sense of feeling grateful, yes, allow it to be there, demonstrate it, show it, But be clear how you're going to get a long-term return on that talent, because it's likely that that talent at that point in time, Bruce, is one of the heftiest salaries and biggest investments you make in this notion called human capital.
You also want that talent to be able to flourish. You want that talent to be able to shine. You want them to be to feel valued and valuable, but not indispensable at the same time, because that can be, you know, quite a dangerous game to play.
Always a dangerous game. I'll never forget a meeting that I attended with a fairly large business. There was a big transaction that was taking place, and sitting next to me was the lead, the operational lead of the transaction. And Bruce, that's someone who I know really well, after the meeting, went on for about 4 hours, everyone vacated the room. I turned around to him and I said, have you got all of that? He said, absolutely. I said, because I was looking at your notebook and I couldn't read it. It seemed to me to be hieroglyphics. He said, it's my code on how to implement this transaction. I said, why in code? He says, because, Pavlin, he looked me in the eye. Let them try and get rid of me. And that is all you need to think about as a business owner. When you have someone who's going to hold you over the barrel at a crucial point in time in your business's growth or career, yeah, that's the cost of not getting it right. You learn that lesson once.
And I'm sure your blood ran cold as mine just did, and yours probably cooled fractionally telling that story. Pavlo Fotidis at Auric Business Accelerator, the founder of Auric Business Accelerator. Sage advice for growing businesses here on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
Investment School tonight with David Shapiro. David Shapiro, of course, is a stockbroker with lots of experience. He is somebody who's seen the evolution of South Africa's mining industry. And just to remind you, on the day that Nelson Mandela was released from prison, 23 out of the top 40 shares on the JSE. So this is 1990. This is within living memory. 23 of the shares on the South African main board out of the top 40 were gold mining companies. And what followed was a period of consolidation. There was a period of growth. There was a period of optimism and opportunism. And South Africa's mining sector grew exponentially in subsequent decades as we saw international managers coming in and taking South Africa's mining industry increasingly global. Well, today, a bid by BHP Group, which at one time absorbed a company called Glencore, also a South African gem, into its fold, and then promptly proceeded to ignore South Africa. Today, they expressed an interest to continue ignoring South Africa. They want to buy Anglo American, but keep the South African assets out of the mix. The Anglo will need to sell its South African businesses if this deal is to go ahead. So what we've done is we've asked David Shapiro to come and give us a context, an explanation. Help us to understand where the pitfalls and opportunities lie in this particular transaction. And if it is a deal that one should go ahead, and if it does go ahead, what does it mean for the future of the JSE? What does it mean for the future of your pension fund? What does it mean? So let's start, I don't know, at the beginning. David Shapiro at Sasfin. He is the chief global equity strategist at Sasfin. We've seen these pictures happen before, and Anglo's is vulnerable and BHP is hungry for growth. David, what's your reading of this offer?
It actually came as a surprise, but not really a surprise, because, Bruce, Anglo's been having difficulties. I mean, ever since it went through to London, you mentioned the 90s, but when they made the move to transfer their primary listing to London, they thought that everything would open up, and yet it became a period of difficult growth. And having been probably in the 70s, 80s, I can't remember the exact numbers, they were certainly one of the major mining houses in the world, with a whole array of assets. You mentioned they're mainly gold. De Beers was one of their big assets, but they had platinum, coal, and also heavy industrial interests in that. Of course, they unbundled a lot of that as they made the move to concentrate on pure mining, but somehow it just didn't gel. It never really worked for them. And the odd thing is that BHP BHP Billiton, as we remember it, was actually conceived by Brian Gilbertson, who came out of Gencore. And Gencore was actually a mining company that Anglos had started or helped start to promote the Afrikaans businessman. I'm not sure the date, whether it was in the 40s or 50s or thereabouts or even 60s and that. And here you are, the child, or what would you call it, the progeny of Billiton coming back and buying its dad. You know, there's a lot of irony in it. The thing is that Billiton today, Bruce, is four times the size of Anglo's, you know, if you look at it on pure market cap. So it gives you an idea of how this business has, how Billiton has grown, developed, and Anglo's unfortunately not kept pace at all. So, that, you know, today it's really a fraction of the size that it used to be and fraction of the power that it used to have.
But it is globally a fraction of the size of where it could be, should be, and maybe could have been. It is, however, a very significant and important player, not only in corporate South Africa, but in terms of valuations of shares on the JSE, the Anglo-American balance sheet, which is upon which, as David Mackay explained to us earlier, upon which Kumba and Anglo-American Platinum rely when the cycles turn and things get tough. They know they've got a big cousin in London to look after them. And of course, within there is De Beers as well, which occasionally has needed a little bit of love and support. Anglo-American also, because of its size and scale of its importance in the mining industry, is critical in mining centers. I mean, you can't imagine the sort of the platinum belt without the high level cover of Anglo-American. It is a big and important player.
Dead right. Dead. Bruce, that's the vulnerability, and perhaps that's the worry. Because if this deal goes through, I don't think the new CEO, Duncan Wanblad, Wanblad, I think, however you pronounce it, I apologize if I'm pronouncing it wrong.
Wanblad. I think it's Wanblad. He hasn't shouted Wanblad, at me for calling him Wanblad. I think it's Wanblad.
Yeah, they were in the process of restructuring. You know, he's taken over and he's more concerned about the future profitability, sustainability of Anglo's. And it was being dragged down by Anglo Platts. And by, of course, Kumba. Although Kumba's a very decent operation, but you know the problems here. You know, if you go through the Anglo-Platts results, if you go through Kumba's having problems getting goods down to the harbor, in fact, they cut back on production simply because they don't want to increase production because they can't get rid of it. They can't ship it out. You know, I don't have to repeat all the problems that are holding back corporate South Africa. The same thing with Anglo-Platts, whether it's electricity, the platinum prices also haven't helped. But you made a very important point. Anglo's is always there as a backstop for this. And it always has been. It's always been considered a mining finance house. It was a mining finance house from the inception of the business. So if Anglo's goes, who's going to be there to stand behind Anglo Platts? Who's going to be there to stand behind Kumba? I think they would have got rid of De Beers as well. The only problem is it's not a listed company. So they would have had to list it first and then unbundle it. Somewhere down the line, De Beers is going to go as well. This is a very clean way of doing it, as they have proposed. In other words, they will give Anglo's, the shares that Anglo's own in Anglo Platts will be given to Anglo-American shareholders, and the same thing with Kumba. But they couldn't do it with De Beers because De Beers is not listed, but it will go as well. So what's going to happen to these businesses? Who's going to stand behind them? Big problem, I think, that has to be considered down the line.
So then, very briefly, and we'll pause for a moment, gather our thoughts and return for how we behave as investors in these companies, these various companies. Do we take the profits and run? Do we look at the signals that are being sent by BHP Group that the future is still very much in the old world, a commodity of copper? Because that's what it really wants out of Anglo American. Mm. Should the deal go ahead or not, how do we respond as investors? David Shapiro is the global head of strategy, equity strategy at SASFIN. That's where he is. I knew it. There's the sign. And he is with us this evening on our investment school to help us make better decisions. Help us make better decisions in the face of a potential offer for one of South Africa's most valuable companies.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
We're talking to David Shapiro at SASFIN and how to respond. If you bought Anglo American shares yesterday, you've made an 18% profit in a single day. You made an 18% profit in a single day. That's not a bad return. Do you take the money and run? Or do you stay invested and bet that at some point, either BHP Group is going to have to make a bigger offer, or, as we heard earlier, there may very well be other suitors at play for a whole bunch of assets within the Anglo-American stable that could make you even more money. If, when SAB Miller was first approached by AB InBev, you'd taken the first offer, you would have been considerably poorer than if you'd held out to the last minute. There are other deals, of course, which have fallen over, and companies have taken many, many years to reach the original valuation, or never at all. David Shapiro at SASFIN. How do we respond to an offer that may or may not come?
You wait. This is definitely going to be increased. There's no doubt about it. You know, every deal is sweetened. And I think the share price is telling that already. If you look at the value that Billiton is making for Anglos, it comes to 25 pounds, 8 pence. Already the share price is at 25.60. So the market's saying this is not good enough. And I have no doubt that those copper assets, which Billiton's after, are very valuable. And this is one of the reasons, you know, that Anglo's was undervalued on the market. It was dragged down by the local assets. But the copper assets are certainly looked for and, you know, are will be in demand. So hang around. This is going to get it's going to get much better for you. And Bruce, yeah, you know, you asked the question of what do we do. I think that investors are looking for, as Billiton have said, what they call future-facing commodities. You know, commodities that are going to be in strong demand for the future. You know, for future digitization, that are going to use by technology, that are going to use renewable energy, electric vehicles and all of that. And copper is one of the big players there and is one that's going to be in demand. So I think everybody's trying to bulk up their copper assets. So it will transform the business because Billiton is very heavy into iron ore. It's into metallurgical coal, you know, the kind of coal used for production of steel. And of course, copper as well. And potash as well. Potash being used for fertilizer, sustainability. So that's where the investment is going. Those are the kind of assets that people want in commodities. And so I think the combined company will be a very powerful, strong business. I think this will go through. I think at the price, it will go through. And I think the local, you know, Anglos will want it. Remember, they've got rid of all the loyalties. The Oppenheimers are gone. You know, all those old timers who used to be part of the royalty of South Africa, no longer there. You know, even 44 Main Street, I think, is now a school or a university. It was given away. Mm. 44 Main Street was Buckingham Palace. Or
We incredibly tied to the legacy of Anglo American. We see it as part and parcel of the environment. But the signal that is being sent by, there are a couple of signals being sent by BHP here. The first is it doesn't believe that South Africa's mining sector is investable. That's a big one. And I wonder how we should respond to that. The second one is it's also sending a signal that it believes copper is the future. How do we respond to that? First question, South Africa mining and investability,
whatever you say is right. And I think government have got to wake up. You know, this is not perhaps the platform to attack government, but I think it's a very strong message that we need to get things together here. every one of the mining companies here, from Thungela to the, you know, to the coal companies, to iron ore, platinum, whoever it is, complain about infrastructure and the inability to actually do what they're supposed to do as mine and mine at a profit, you know, Richards Bay, wherever we look. So there's an absolute need to get that right. And we've got to lay down the infrastructure. There's huge opportunities here. I haven't heard from Peter Major for a long time. I don't know, our paths haven't crossed, but he's always wonderful to talk about the opportunities that are here, you know, in South Africa.
Okay.
There's still, you know, they're wonderful opportunities.
Okay. I think that's a very good point. We will invite him to the Money Show tomorrow, and our Money Show explainer, and say, right, BHP Group says there's no opportunity. Is there? And that's the question. Producers are nodding. They're smiling. Thumbs up. Look at that. Everyone's happy. Now, David, the signal that is being sent also by BHP is that it's not interested in diamonds. It's not interested in South African iron ore or platinum, because it's got its eyes on, it regards to be a bigger prize. The bigger prize being copper. Copper that powered the third industrial revolution, that will power the fourth industrial revolution. Mm. And they're willing to pay up for it very, very seriously.
Yes. And Bruce, the other point is, I have no doubt around the world there will be assets, you know, somewhere hidden in the earth or in the mountains of Peru or Chile. There's copper, but you don't want to go and buy some kind of deposit now and spend the next 2-10 years chipping away and trying to get to it. So the easiest way to do it is to actually buy an existing operation. And I think that's what Billiton's doing. It's not unusual. Anglos were past masters at that. You know, Kumba was owned by Eskom. I think wherever we've been, you know, they've actually accumulated assets. So it's even De Beers. If you go back to the history of De Beers, it was owned by Cecil Rhodes and the Bonata boys and brothers. So it's the easy way to do it. So they would rather pay up and know that they can get payback almost immediately and have to now go and find deposits and spend years and go through huge kind of hassles now trying to find a mine. So I think that's also part of the reason why they will pay up for these assets, you know. And also, as you said earlier, there are a lot of other birds of prey around waiting to pounce on this as well. Certainly Rio's or someone like that. Have they got this kind of money? Would you do a share swap with Rio's? I'm not sure. You know, I'm quite happy with Billiton.
How does this affect the value of my retirement annuity? How does it affect the value of my long-term investments? BHP Group comes in, takes up Anglo-American, doesn't want the South African bits, and takes the best global assets it sees them. What happens to the value of the JSE? What happens to investors who are invested in this business?
It won't affect them. In fact, you would rather have a company like BHP, which is capitalized, about 3 trillion rand, with plenty of muscle to expand, to go into new projects. It's got lots of cash. It's got a balance sheet that can sustain, you know, poorer times, high margin businesses. So, but it's by far a better business than Anglo's. So you're actually swapping an underperforming asset or an underperforming company or a company with issues for a much better business. I think that's what it comes down to. So BHP's listed on the share of JSE. Okay. You will still get value for it.
Okay, that's important. However, had I been terribly excited about AB InBev's takeover of SAB and I'd stayed invested in AB InBev, I'd be very disappointed. Here's one, the world's biggest brewing company buying the world's second biggest brewing company, pays a massive premium, £46 or whatever it was on the at the time, £100 billion takeover, biggest on the London Stock Exchange, rah, rah, rah. The company's worth less today than on the day that they bought SAB Miller. It's from an investment perspective, not been good.
No, but at the time, AB InBev bought breweries with debt. It was heavily indebted. You know, if you go and look at the structure, so from that point of view, debt is kind of weighed on them for many, many years. I personally think that breweries were significantly better than AB InBev. It was a much better business. And at the end, of course, the price was just, you couldn't turn away from it. But I think the structure of the deals, just recall the debt issues that AB InBev have and how long it's taken them to wind it down. I still think it drags them down. And this is mining. There's a big difference between booze and mining. You know, I think you can produce bottles of beer in any country at any time, at any shape. But copper deposits, not that easy to define, as I explained. So I think different structures. And Bruce, it's important, you know, that's the beauty of mining companies, is that it's not easy to get these deposits. You know, you've got to go through so many hurdles and hoops and that to get it approved to eventually mine and that. So although the global economy is it's stuttering at the moment as well, it will come back. But I like BHP. I think it's a superbly run business.
Mm. Thank you, David Shapiro at Sasfin. Very, very valuable input for us this evening, explaining the opportunities open to you as BHP sniffs around Anglo's draws, so to speak, on The Money Show.